It's time to begin the plans and determine the strategy for winning a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever known before.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
Under the protection of certain inalienable political...
Back in 1944, I think it was, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president, gave a State of the Union message, and he called for a second Bill of Rights.
A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
And this Bill of Rights was going to be the right to a home, the right to a job, the right to a certain income. And it was 10 things that were more tangible and therefore more difficult to actually win in the United States.
The right of every family to a decent home.
Robert Neuwirth is the author of Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. He estimates that more than a billion people, that's one in seven, are squatters.
You know, there is an acceptance in other countries in the world that puts us to shame. And that acceptance is that no one should be without a home.
The right of every family to a decent home.
And so that there was some way in which the squatters were right. Even though there may be all sorts of problems with how their communities developed and the rich people living next door may be somewhat perturbed or angry about it and there's bad relationships. But there is a sense that people are doing what they need to do because everyone needs four walls and a roof.
Right of every family to a decent home.
This week on Making Contact, we visit squats in Venezuela and the Philippines and find out why squatters aren't just tolerated, they're crucial to the growth of major cities and national economies. To begin, reporter Andrew Rosati brings us to what's known as the world's tallest squat to see how the residents there are dealing with the latest round of evictions by the government.
At the foot of what's been called the world's tallest slum, William Gonzalez watches a pickup basketball game. When I talk to him, he gets a bit nostalgic. This might be one of the last games played here. About half the residents have already moved out of Torre de David. And tomorrow, another 75 families are scheduled to leave.
Some people have been here 6 months, others three. Some have been here a year. I've been living here 7 years. Some who haven't lived here as long as me cry as they'd left. Part of me wants to leave quickly, but at the same time, I don't want to go.
William is not alone. People from all across the country inhabit 28 floors of the tower, and many I've talked to are anxious about leaving. Besides the basketball court, residents set up chapels, barbershops, even a motorbike taxi service that takes you up to the 10th floor. As I head to the top of the building, I meet Gladys Flores, who's in charge of the 15th floor. She was part of the first wave that moved here in 2007. Some came out of necessity, others for the comfort of living in the city center.
About 2,000 families lived in tents for 3 months while we cleared out the rubble, built the walls, and cleaned the floors for the safety of the kids.
Gladys' apartment reflects the care some residents take of their homes, complete with modern furnishings and a balcony offering a stunning view of the city. Other families, though, live on damp floors and tack up old bed sheets for walls. Gladys says that in any society, there will be all walks of life. Wandering through the tower, I meet street hawkers, cab drivers, waiters, and others who are unemployed.
We understand, and it's clear to me, that social distortions exist everywhere, and people conduct themselves in different ways, and that doesn't just happen here in the tower. We're practically a town, an organized vertical community with social distortions.
Occupying vacant land or buildings is not new here. Like the favelas in Brazil, Caracas is surrounded by shanty towns. Andre Santillano, a university professor and activist for squatters' rights, explains that for decades, Venezuela's poor flocked to the city's outskirts, leading to the growth of today's slums.
Entonces, de esa forma, entre el 50-60% de la población venezolana ha vivido en barrios.
In this way, as many as 50-60% of the population have lived in slums that are the result of illegal land occupation. Public services and the conditions of life are precarious, and it's been like this for a long time.
In search of better conditions, Andre says people began occupying urban spaces just before the late Hugo Chavez came to power. But with the socialist leaders' rise, more and more squatters began to take over vacant buildings, garages, warehouses, and construction sites.
People began to believe that it is a way to assert their right to a home. I've been in occupations where people say, Chavez said we all have a right to a home, and since the government hasn't provided us one, we're occupying this one.
Critics fault the government for turning a blind eye and allowing families to occupy hundreds of buildings in Caracas, especially now when crime is soaring and the economy is sinking. Supporters say buildings like the Tower of David attest to Chavez's efforts to put citizens' basic welfare above corporate interests. Now that the residents in the tower are being evicted, some wonder whether if Chavez were still alive, if he would have allowed them to stay.
We never refused to return the building. There was never a moment that we thought about not giving it back. But I always thought with Chavez, perhaps things would have turned out differently.
The government says it's looking to redevelop central Caracas, and the tower is not suitable for habitation. Squatters are being moved to free public housing. But the site residents are being moved to is about 25 miles outside Caracas. I travel to see how the relocated residents are getting on. Life in the tower wasn't easy, with no elevator and lacking many basic services. Still, some like Jacqueline Calderon are finding life outside the tower tough. She left her job and her social circle behind.
Even though I imagined completely starting over, like many others, I got depressed. I'm making new friends because even though we all lived in the tower, we didn't know everyone. Now my social circle has completely changed.
Others, like Yolimar Noriega, says even though there are hardships, the prospect of finally having a home to call their own outweighs any of the difficulties.
It's been complicated for some of the residents, but I imagine one of the things they always wanted was a decent home. Now they have it. The hardest part is over.
As residents continue to move out, the fate of the tower remains uncertain. Some officials have even floated the idea of demolishing it. Meanwhile, hundreds of other squats remain in central Caracas. For Making Contact, I'm Andrew Rosati in Caracas, Venezuela.
Making contact.
You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Joining me now is Robert Neuwirth. He's the author of Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's talk about what a squatter is. For those of us in the West, we may picture a bunch of kids wearing black, all punked out in an abandoned home or something like that. But what is a squatter? What's the global picture of squatters?
Well, yeah, it's very different. We do have that picture, and it's kind of pejorative in some ways. But in most of the world, squatting is a family issue, which means it's based on the fact that the urban economy works, the rural economy doesn't work, and people go from the rural area to the city seeking jobs. When they get to the city, they can find a job, but they can't find a home. So they wind up joining with some other urban migrants and seizing land and building their own homes. And so typically it's not an already built building that's occupied by some kind of youthful, punked out or anarchist or whatever grouping. It's a bunch of folks who are just trying to survive and bring their families to the city too, who take over land and build a shack. And over time, those shacks are, a cardboard shack is turned into a wood shack, and a wood shack is turned into a brick shack, and a brick shack is turned into a reinforced concrete shack with a second floor. And then it's not a shack anymore. It's an apartment building.
And is this new? Is this post-industrial revolution, or has this always been the
Well,
case?
I mean, when do you date the industrial revolution? Sure, it's new in the sense that it's rural to urban migration has really taken off since the 1960s and the structural adjustment programs that created economic dislocation in the developing world. But in a way, it's not new at all. I mean, if we go back in history, it's actually how our cities developed. San Francisco had tons of squatters. It was developed by squatters during the gold rush. And Golden Gate Park was occupied by squatters before there was a deal made to legalize the rest of the squatters in the city and turn Golden Gate Park into a park. New York City had squatters on the Upper West and Upper East Side. They were, you know, before those neighborhoods were developed. We're talking 150 years ago. So this is a common form of urban development in the States, in Europe, everywhere. It just so happens that we're seeing the phenomenon in a different way now because it's happening in the developing world while we in our developed cities no longer see the same extent of squatting and the same type of squatting.
Now, are there problems related to squatting? I guess I should say, what are the problems related to squatting? To research your book, you went to Mumbai, you went to Rio,
Istanbul,
Nairobi, and Istanbul, four main cities, but I know you also studied a lot of other cities.
Yeah.
It seems the problems that we might think there exist related to squatting are maybe not the problems we should be addressing.
Right. Well, that's certainly true. You know, we, and particularly the sort of aid-minded people, see deprived material conditions. We see the house and we say, oh my God, people are living in a mud hut. And it's true. People are living in a mud hut. And I don't want to say that that's great. But if you ask the people, which I did. I went around, let's take in Nairobi. I went around Kibera and many of the other shanty towns of Nairobi. And I asked people if you could articulate two things that you wanted or one thing that you wanted or three things that you wanted, what would they be? And it was never the house. It was never the bricks and mortar. It was roads. It was street lighting, electricity, water. It was infrastructure. It was not the structure. And so our problem is that we go in with a mindset of, oh my God, these poor people are living in a degraded house. And we don't recognize that their point of view is, if you give us control over this house, we'll rebuild this house 20 times over until we make it into something that's really nice. We need the goodies that cities should provide. Sewers, water, infrastructure, road pattern that we can all agree on and that people don't get evicted from, but that's what we need. And I'd say 90% of the time, people didn't mention a better house. They mentioned the infrastructure that would give them a better life. People need to know that these are tremendously commercially vibrant places. You know, we have this view when we hear shantytown or the UN term of art is slum. We think, you know, just colossally concentrated misery. And, you know, I'm not saying that living without water or without sewers is a picnic, but the amount of commercial vibrancy in these communities, I mean, in the mud hut neighborhood of Kibera, there's just, you know, store after store after store on the main drag. There are bars, there are little concert halls, there are churches, there are beauty salons, there are cafes, there are, I mean, and hundreds, thousands of these businesses all throughout the community. So we need to recognize that these are really where people live and work. People don't have to leave the so-called slum or shantytown to make their money, to live their life, to send their kids to school. There are schools within these communities. And that's really super important to recognize, that these communities are not only emblems of misery.
Are there cities that are making productive movement towards giving the squatters what they need?
Well, I mean, some cities are. Rio has, the situation has changed now because of the coming of the World Cup and the Olympics, which we can talk about later. It's a separate issue. But when I was in Rocinha, the people there got electricity by stealing it. Now, I'm actually in favor of that, but we can talk about why. But they stole electricity, and for years the public utility said, well, this is horrible, we have to cut these people off, they're stealing it. And at a certain point they realized, wait, these people will pay. And so they went into the community and made a deal. They basically said, we'll give you legal electricity, we'll spend the money, we'll put up the poles and bring legal electricity if you take a meter. And, you know, The vast majority of people in this community, which is about 200,000 people, said, sure, we'll take a meter and give us the electricity. So this was a way of bringing exactly what people needed, stable electricity that didn't short out in the rain, to the squatter community, even while people don't have, quote unquote, property rights. And what that also does is it gives them staying power. Because once people have electricity, it's hard to say, oh, my God, you know, you're awful, you're evil. They're paying. They're legitimate citizens who are paying for their power like everyone else. And that begins to give them legitimacy within the power structure, which is super important. They are, in some sense, taking power, and they are giving themselves a kind of quasi-governmental control over their own lives.
And then another objection I think you hear from people is, especially with the high cost of rent, I have to pay rent for my place. Why do these people get to just set up on a plot of land and not have to pay?
Well, you know, first of all, try doing it, right? It's not a picnic. I mean, people work really hard to build their homes, starting with nothing. And their mortgage is their time, if you look at it that way. You know, what do we do? If we have the money, we get a bank to give us all the money and we build a home, all right? They don't have the collateral. And so their mortgage is, I'll build it today out of cardboard. When I have another $200, I'll tear down one cardboard wall and I'll build that out of wood. When I have another, you know, and it goes on like that. And then they do it, once it's all wood, they do it all over again from wood to brick. And over 20 years, which might be the life of a normal mortgage here, they wind up with a poured concrete and brick and reinforced concrete, maybe a second story, maybe a third story home. And if you look at it that way, then you say their mortgage is just different than ours. And they've put a tremendous amount of investment into their home. And they pay upkeep, which would be the maintenance of a, you know, condo or a co-op. So, and in some cases they pay rent. If I have built a second story on my squatter home, I can rent that out. And then that new squatter is actually a rent-paying tenant of me, the squatter landlord. So that economy mirrors the economy in the formal world. So, you know, I'd urge anyone who thinks that this is a picnic to go and try doing it. People work really hard and deal with a lot of deprivation just to have a roof over their head.
Robert Neuwirth is the author of Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World, and his newest book is called Stealth of Nations. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it was a great pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
Philippine capital of Manila, more than 500,000 people live as squatters, or as they prefer to be called, informal settlers. Without land titles, their right to stay in their homes is regularly challenged by the government and private landowners. Despite this, some Manila squatters have found power in numbers, wielding their electoral weight to their advantage. Reporter Aurora Almendral visited one settlement along a Manila waterway and finds out how one community leveraged their political power into homes.
I'm on Taft Avenue. It's a main street in the center of Manila. And right off of it are these narrow little alleyways. Down this one is a squatter neighborhood called Estero de San Miguel. The passageway is 5 or 6 feet wide. Some boys are playing basketball with a homemade hoop, and neighbors are leaning out of windows, watching the world go by. 100 families, or about 500 people, live here. The homes are hammered together out of flimsy plywood and corrugated tin. Some of them are on stilts over the canal, which is really gray and murky from the sewage of all the makeshift homes squeezed into this cramped space. This is pretty typical of squatter settlements here in Manila. There's almost no formal infrastructure, no plumbing. Electricity is usually jumped from a main line. The canal can flood pretty badly during typhoons. It doesn't smell great, and it's not much to look at. But the people from here love their neighborhood.
Here in this Terra de San Miguel, we like to live here because it's very practical. We are near, just for walking distance from the school of our children. We are near with the hospital, we are near to the market, we are near to the church.
That's Filomena Cinco. She's the barangay captain, or elected leader of the neighborhood of Estero de San Miguel. Besides the prime location, Cinco says that over the decades, they've built a strong sense of camaraderie.
At yung nangangailangan naman, halimbawa, walang maisaing o walang malutong food.
For example, if a family doesn't have any food to cook, then we all get together and give food to that family.
For that family. And at the same time, lahat ng problema, kung halimbawa,
we help solve each other's problems. Like if someone loses their job, we help them out. We give them something to do, like clean the canal in exchange for some money. It's a system of support of each other. Here, when one person has a problem, it's all of our problem, and we solve it together.
Binibigyan namin siya ng bayan. So yung sistema ng suporta sa bawat isa. Nagtutulungan kami dito. Problema ng isa, problema ng community, sinasolve namin ng sama-sama.
Just this week, the community collected money to pay for an old woman's hospital visit. When the whole neighborhood burned down a few years ago, they got together and rebuilt each other's homes within a week. In Tagalog, it's a system called bayanihan, or communal work. And for the people of Estero de San Miguel, that social togetherness is something worth fighting for.
Kasi nanindigan talaga namin, ayaw namin doon sa relocation na yun. Yun nga, sinabi ko talaga na how serious we are.
We stood our ground against a relocation before. To show them how serious I was, I said, over my dead body. I said those words, over my dead body. If you take down one roof or a single nail or demolish anything, there's going to be a revolution. We stood our ground, not just me, but the whole community.
Hindi lang ako, but the whole community. We fight for it that we will not go to off-city relocation. We want to stay here. Listen to us. This is our plan.
For decades, the Philippine government had a policy of relocating squatter families to the outer reaches of Manila, also known as off-city. But the relocation sites seldom had the economic infrastructure that attracted the squatters to the city in the first place. There were no schools, no hospitals, no markets. So many of them ended up moving back to the city and starting another cycle of squatting. People like Cinco are willing to put up with substandard housing in Manila to be close to the things they need to live. And the dependence goes both ways. They also work the jobs that the city needs in order to function.
Our women here are sidewalk vendors. They are selling goods within the university belt. Then most of the tatays here are pedicab drivers, security guards, carpenters, and also stevedore in the nearest market. So it's just a walking distance from this community. Most of the workforce of the government of the city comes from the ISF families. The janitors, the messengers, the security guards. But we have also skilled workers and professionals here because many of our children have graduated also from the colleges and they are now private employees. Some of them are working with the government na. Talagang the city needs us because most of the workforce of the city comes from the ISF.
ISF stands for Informal Settler Families. They're part of the economic fabric of the city. They're just not paid enough to live in it.
Hindi talaga sapat yung income kahit pa.
Their income really isn't enough. Even if they're government employees, their salaries are very minimal because they're not professionals.
But however poor Manila squatters are, they're not powerless. Luz Sudeste is with an organization called Urban Poor Associates.
Kung marami kayo, kung may numbers kayo, you can ask to the government. You can pressure the government.
If there are a lot of you, you can pressure the government. But if there are only a few of you, you don't have the numbers. You're not going to be able to influence the government. So it's a matter of how many of you there are struggling against the issue that you want to stay in a place. If there are only a few of you, there's no way to influence the government. You need a burst.
Urban Poor Associates organizes communities like Estero de San Miguel to form a united front to lobby the government for squatters' rights. Several squatter communities in Manila's waterways banded together in 2010 when the government started an initiative to relocate their communities. The aim was to take people out of harm's way. About 900 people died in severe flooding here in 2009, and to improve the city's drainage infrastructure. But when the government turned to faraway relocation sites as a solution, residents like Filomena Cinco weren't happy.
They see us always, and they consider us, the ISF, as the problem of the society. Well, in fact, actually, we are not the problem. It's just the system of the government that's the big problem. The old policy of sending off the ISF to distant relocation, even without asking them, asking us, we strongly lobbied for that rights.
With the backing of UPA, the informal settlers approached Benigno Aquino III, who was running for president. They offered him the electoral support of the urban poor in exchange for an open dialogue on demolition, relocation, and decent housing. In May of 2010, Aquino won the presidency.
It helped us that when President Noy won as a president, and the government became friendly to us because we're allies na. So it helps talaga a lot.
The Aquino government doesn't outwardly acknowledge the electoral deal and sometimes even denies it. But it's an open secret that the government has been hearing out the squatters' demands. Rather than accepting a distant relocation site, the people of Estero de San Miguel proposed an alternate plan to the government. They were awarded government-subsidized housing, a five-minute walk from their current settlement. Their future homes will be concrete, three stories tall, earthquake-safe, and far enough from the waterway to keep them out of danger. Each unit has its own bathroom, indoor plumbing, and electricity, and will cost between 500 to 1,000 pesos, or $11 to $22 a month. The buildings are painted bright pink, turquoise, and blue, and the children of Estero de San Miguel have started a mural on the side of a newly built wall.
It's important to us because we inherited being squatters from our grandparents. We don't want to pass that on to our children and our grandchildren and even the generation after that. We want their dignity as a family, as people, to be returned to them.
For Estero de San Miguel, their in-city relocation is, without a doubt, a victory. But they are an exception. Only a couple dozen ISF communities have the same kind of organizing power. There are still over 100,000 families living along Manila's waterways, all of whom are slated for relocation in 2015. For Making Contact, I'm Aurora Almendral in Manila, Philippines.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. To learn more about the people and groups in this show or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Laura Flynn, George Lavender, Jasmine Lopez, and Quan Booth. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.